All right, here we go. 6:13, Tuesday, July 15th. As we matriculate into hurricane season, there is a little area off the coast of Florida and the Gulf and extending to Alabama, maybe even to us, but they're expecting it to only be a rain producer. However, they're going to watch it just to make sure. That's going to give us an 85% chance for showers on Thursday and Friday, looking pretty rainy. Maybe beginning tomorrow. Today, for the most part, dry. However, there is always a chance of that pop-up shower. So be aware of that. We're watching the weather in the Gulf, and we'll let you know if there's anything you need to do or worry about. But right now, it's just looking like a rain event. Ted Rossman joins us now, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst, to talk about a survey that they did about tipping. How you doing, Ted?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Tell me what the survey was about.
We've done this for several years now. We ask people about various forms of tipping culture, you know, who they're tipping, how much, how they feel about it. People are feeling pretty negative about tipping. About two-thirds of Americans have at least one negative viewpoint towards tipping. That's been on the rise, 63% this year. Last year it was 59%. The most common negative viewpoints are 41% who say that businesses should just pay their staff better rather than relying so much on tips. Also, 41% say that tipping culture has just gotten out of control. That's really exemplified by all this tip creep that's gone on, being asked to tip in unconventional settings. I was asked to tip once at a self-checkout machine at Newark Airport and at a pick-your-own strawberry farm. I mean, that's the kind of thing people are talking about.
Yeah, well, tipping a kiosk is kind of, you know, actually, though, I was at a fast food place, and now that you mentioned it, Ted, out of force of habit, I tipped the kiosk. I can't believe I did that. I suddenly realized that I was getting a French fries and a patty melt, and it gave me an option of a tip, and it's like, well, okay, you know, I guess why not, whatever, 10%. And I realized that I didn't tip a human being. I tipped the kiosk, although I guess I was thinking that maybe I was tipping the human beings behind the scenes. I don't know. Tipping is not something that is worldwide, right? And isn't that a uniquely American thing?
It is a largely American phenomenon, although we've been hearing that even some places in Europe that have been famously anti-tipping in the past, even they are starting to push it a little bit more, especially in touristy areas. Not as much as we see it in the U.S., but I have heard that there are some restaurants in Europe that are starting to ask for tips, or it's catching on a little bit. From the employer standpoint, it's a great thing because it's a way to funnel more money to your workers without having to foot the bill. And that's one of the biggest reasons why we're seeing more of it here in the States, too. And it's something that technology is enabling, that it's easier than ever to embed a tipped prompt in the point of sale, whether that's a payment terminal or an app. With all the inflation that we've seen the past few years, everybody's looking for more money, right? But businesses are hesitant to raise prices more than they have. So many have kind of turned to tipping as a bit of a hidden surcharge. It's a way to raise prices without raising prices. Starbucks is an interesting example. A few years ago, they debuted credit and debit card tip prompts when you pay at their stores. And they say about half of customers are leaving a tip in those instances. And that has to be way more than the percentage that was putting money in the old-fashioned tip jar. People kind of grumble about this, but they end up tipping anyway. And it really is additive for the worker. It's just something that a lot of customers are complaining about.
As we talk about this, I think about the Seinfeld episode where George puts his tip in a jar and they don't see it, so he reaches in to get it and they think he's stealing tips. And I always thought that if they don't see you put the tip in the jar, it doesn't count, right? So maybe with the electronic screen, they know or something. I don't know. Maybe that's part of the psychology?
Yeah, sometimes they probably know. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's awkward with the cashier and other customers looking at you. You know, sometimes I've heard with these various delivery services like DoorDash and Instacart, sometimes you'll get better service if you tip. It's confusing, though, because sometimes people want to wait until after the delivery to see how it went. So, you know, maybe they're planning on giving cash at the actual point of pickup, but if they haven't put some kind of credit or debit card tip into the machine. Sometimes they don't get as good service. You know, that gets back to just the whole nature of tipping in general. Some people quip that the process means to ensure promptness, that tip is kind of an acronym. I've heard that's actually largely a myth, but in practice, it can work out that way, that you know, there's different motivations for tipping. We tip to reward good service. We tip to be nice and say thank you. Sometimes we tip to get better service next time. There's a lot that goes into it. And at a time when a lot of people are feeling strapped for money as it is, there has been a bit of a backlash against tipping. And some people say that it's just kind of gone too far. And we've actually seen people tipping less for a variety of services in recent years, whether that's because they don't have the money or they're annoyed about it. The trend kind of stabilized a bit this year. A lot of these categories were pretty flat year over year or even up slightly. But if we zoom out to the past 4 or 5 years, that's where we definitely see a noticeable decline. You know, for example, only 54% are always tipping their hairstylist or barber. That's down from 63% back in 2021. There's been a 5 percentage point decline in the percentage tipping at restaurants. Percentage tipping for food delivery is down 7%. Really across the board, people have pulled back a bit on their tipping behavior.
Let me open the Open Art Jeweler Talking text line. I'll read your text when we come back. 504-260-1870 about tipping. Thoughts on it? When do you do it? When do you not do it? And, you know, some of the thoughts that come to my mind are, do you tip the owner of the shop or is that an insult? I always kind of looked at it as, if you tip the owner, that's an insult, but maybe not because they're just looking for the money. 504-260-1870, please. No texting and driving. And the other question that I have, and we'll talk about this when we come back, is it seems as though if I'm not going to get as good service with my food delivery, which I never have food delivered, but if I don't tip you ahead of time, then it seems like we're kind of straddling the line of extortion there where, you know, God forbid a brick go through your window. You pay me $20 a month, I'll make sure a brick doesn't go through your window. 621 traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Ted Rossman, Banker 8 senior industry analyst. Out of control, pay employees better. Those are just two of the responses in a recent survey about tipping culture. We're talking about it with Ted Rossman. Some of the texts are coming in. Drive for Lyft. It's a side hustle. Always get told I'm going to put your tip in the app. Never see it. I just spent 2 weeks in Europe. Everybody wanted tips. Somebody else said I drive for Lyft. People don't even tip from airport to downtown. It's frustrating. So apparently Lyft not the business to be in. I'm in a Modern Family throuple ENM relationship and it was just, anyway. Somebody else said, I'm a working man. I'll pick up a plate lunch during the week at a family restaurant. Do you think I should tip or not? I guess that's up for this person to decide. Who decides what's right and what's not? Ted, the person themselves, I guess?
It's very confusing. I mean, increasingly, some people feel that the business is kind of deciding for them because they're embedding these tip prompts. And we see them at coffee shops and food trucks and elsewhere. And sometimes the amounts are very strategic, that when they present this tip option on the screen, it's not always 10, 15, 20%. I mean, sometimes it starts at 20 and goes up from there or even higher. A lot of people feel pressured to tip in these instances, and it's just kind of giving tipping a bad name overall. I do think that we should be tipping for sit-down restaurant service. That's something that not enough people are doing, though. Only 70% of Americans always tip at a sit-down restaurant. It's really shockingly low among Gen Zers. Like, only 43% of Gen Zers always tip at a sit-down restaurant. Only 61% of millennials do so, versus 83% of Gen X and 84% of boomers. That's one that should be absolute. I think we should also be tipping for food delivery, and yet only 52% are doing that. Only 43% always tip for a taxi or rideshare. I believe we should always be tipping in these instances. What's more optional to me is the counter service transaction. You don't always need to tip for coffee or a quick sandwich pickup, you know, maybe once in a while if you're a regular or you have an especially big or complicated order. I certainly didn't feel bad hitting the no tip button at the self-checkout machine. Sometimes tipping goes too far, but sometimes the backlash is also hurting people in traditionally tipped occupations. The federal tipped minimum wage is only $2.13 an hour. Restaurant wait staff, for example, are really dependent on tips, and it's too bad that many are tipping poorly or not at all.
I hate it. I think, because here's what I hate about it, Ted. I think the restaurant is putting it on me to manage their staff for them. So they want me to reward the employees that are doing well by giving them a raise, and eventually drive off the employees that aren't doing well by stiffing them or not leaving them much of a tip, which means they'll go out and find something else to do, I guess, in the big economic model. And I hate that. I wish there were no tips on anything that the companies would manage, because it's coming out of my pocket either way, right? That the companies would manage their staff, and if the employees did a good job, pay them accordingly. If not, then get rid of them, but don't leave it up to me to make that decision. Am I losing my mind here or not?
I understand that viewpoint. Tipping, though, is very embedded in our society. Danny Myers, a famous restaurateur who tried to do away with tipping a few years ago and just raised prices by 20% to compensate, he thought it would be more fair. Many customers balked at the higher prices, though, even if that's what they should have been paying anyway. And even a lot of staff thought they could make more at the restaurant down the street.
And then that brings up the question of, you know, a party of seven or more, eight or more, they add the tip. Well, some people would prefer that they didn't do that, because if the service is exemplary, I'd like to leave more, although you can leave more if you want to. Other people would say that, you know what, you're guaranteeing a tip, and where's the incentive for the staff to provide good service? The argument goes on. Thank you, Ted. Appreciate it. We'll talk about, speaking of arguments going on in the Middle East when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. People are correcting me on the Guthrie. My point wasn't about the Guthrie. My point was that you think they were born in the heartland and they were actually from New York. That was the point I was trying to make. Bruce Jenelson joins me now, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process, and he helps us understand what's going on over there. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm good, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
I am. So let's tell me, where does it stand now with Iran as far as what we know about their ability to create a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, the attacks both by Israel and the United States inflicted very, you know, serious damage on the Iranian nuclear complex, but well short of President Trump's claim of obliterated. And that's been the view of our own intelligence agencies, the Israelis, as well as the international intelligence agencies. And so we have a truce going on right now, but like a lot of truces, it's unstable. You know, the goal of a truce in any situation is to buy time to deal with the issues. Prime Minister Netanyahu came to Washington for another trip last week. There's a lot of buildup on the trip. And then he left kind of quietly, both on Israel, Gaza, and Iran. So it doesn't really seem that there's any new agreements. And, you know, the Iranian people who very dissatisfied, and that's an understatement, with their own government. But when you're attacked by other countries, it kind of gives you a sense of nationalism. And so any notion that they were going to rally and overthrow this government was really, at best, wishful thinking.
Yeah, it seems to me like you got two different buckets there. You got a bucket of, you got to destroy their ability to make nuclear weapons. But if you think that by attacking the country, you're going to turn the people against the government, it's just the opposite, that if anything, it unifies them, right?
That's right. And that's almost a natural human instinct, right? Any country is like that, whether they're a democracy or a non-democracy. Look, you know, after 9/11, we really, really rallied. We had 80% of the people agreeing about what to do, which is rare in our country. And the other thing is that, you know, it's still unclear where this goes. I mean, Iran could continue on that path. We have no ways of verification, which we had before. And so it's hanging out there as a big uncertainty. And setting it back is a goal, but it leaves a lot to be, you know, to see what happens next.
So you could even bring that down, Bruce, I think, to the family level, where you could say something about your brother, but if I say something about your brother, it's not acceptable at all. Or you could sue your family, but if somebody else sues your family, then y'all are going to all unite, right, together against the common enemy?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's very, very much the case. And, you know, Iran has, you know, the highest literacy rate in the Middle East other than Israel, right? So this is a pretty well-educated, and we've seen a lot of protests from women, from students, from shopkeepers, and others. But, you know, it is their country, and we've run into this a lot of other countries, you know, in Afghanistan, right? We had much more military power. In Iraq, we had much more military power. But one country invading another, you know, doesn't work out very well in most cases.
So one thing that confused me was that there was some talk before the strike as to whether it should have happened. I'm not talking about I'm talking about strategically, not as far as the inner workings of the government. But it would seem as though if now we're saying that we didn't destroy enough, then that kind of destroys the argument that we shouldn't have, or they shouldn't have been an attack, because then that meant they were closer, and they would be even closer if we hadn't attacked. Do you understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Yeah, and ultimately the only solution to this thing is diplomacy, right? There were, you know, when President Obama signed the Iran nuclear nonproliferation deal in 2015, it was one of the few things that also signed that deal were not just the Europeans, but the Russians and the Chinese, right? We were all on the same page on that. And when President Trump came into power the first time in 2016-17, he renounced the deal, and while many people thought it was imperfect, even Israeli intelligence, not Israeli political leaders who had an axe to grind, Israeli intelligence said it was working okay. So you go 10 years, you don't have a deal, Iran makes further progress, and now you attack, and they've still got the capability, and you really ask yourself the question, could those 10 years have been spent better on diplomacy? And going forward now, what's the lesson of that? You're going to have some sort of solid diplomatic deal. There's no way you can do this just militarily.
Diplomacy means allowing people in to inspect, right?
Yeah, that was part of it. In fact, the inspections had continued even after we pulled out of the deal. What's called the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is one of the UN agencies that actually works pretty well. You know, it had cameras in there. They had other ways. They had on-site inspections. And, you know, there was still some concern about deception going on, but it gave you a fair amount of information to work with. And from the Israeli perspective, the Prime Minister Netanyahu has made, you know, Iran like his main political weapon, including getting attention away from what's going on in Gaza. But when you talk to Israeli strategists, they have, you know, they're not soft on Iran, but they also realize the limits of what they can do without a real diplomatic process.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Ultimately, it comes down to, with intelligence, who is allowed to go where, and how do they detect, and how can you hide if you're trying to develop? So we'll pick it up there. We come back with Bruce Donaldson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke. Previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East process, so he knows what's going on there. 651, 9 till 7, traffic, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 657 and a half. I love talking to Bruce Donaldson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process, so he knows the players involved, he knows the history involved. And real quick, Bruce, before we get, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but knowing the history of these countries and the cultures, that's everything when it comes to moving forward, is it not?
It is very much. I mean, even when you negotiate, you know, there are different negotiating styles that different cultures have that you've got to kind of learn and get comfortable with as an American. But sometimes we think history prevents them, like the Shia-Sunni difference in the Arab world. We think they're never going to get together. You know, Iran, which is Shia, and Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni, in the last two or three years have actually restarted diplomatic relations, and Saudi Arabia stood by Iran when it was attacked by us and by the Israelis. So some of that history you need to know, but you need to, you know, it shapes, but it doesn't determine what you can do.
Now we're back to your friend is my, your friend's enemy is my, well, you know how that whole thing goes.
Right.
Somebody texted in and said, we have no way of knowing that Iran currently has nuclear weapons. They're trying to amass a stockpile. One doesn't mean much. Now, whoever texted this in, I appreciate them listening and them texting. I don't know that they have any access to any information that I don't, and I don't know what Iran has. How hard is it to determine when it comes to even nuclear inspectors, who's doing what, where, and how easy is it to hide a nuclear program?
You know, when you have an agreement like we had before, and you have inspectors on the ground, and you have cameras, and then you have your own intelligence. The Israelis have intelligence networks. We do. The Europeans do. And let's just say you can have pretty, 70-80% reliability. So you can't know for sure. But the business of developing a nuclear weapon, it's not just like enriching the fuel of that goes into it. You gotta, have the weapons for delivering it. You gotta go through a whole process. And most of the analysts felt that Iran could do that within a year if it had no inspections and agreements. And now it's been set back. But we know even less. Did they take away some of the material before the attacks because they knew the attacks were coming? We're more blinded now than we were before. It makes it even harder.
Thank you. All right, 7:15, and got that tropical system. I don't even know if it's appropriate to call it that yet, but something going on in the Gulf, and I don't think it's going to really turn into much other than a rainmaker. Could be a named storm. We're watching all of that for you, specifically Peyton Malone and the WWL forecast team. So, yeah, we'll let you know everything you need to know. But as it stands now, looking like maybe some increased chances for rain as we move toward the weekend. Eugene Green joins us now, New Orleans City Council member. How are you, sir?
Talk to you and to your listeners.
Thank you, sir. It's good to have you. Let me ask you about with this storm coming up and the surge in water board and turbines and this and that and the other thing. I know you're not council at large, but thoughts on everything with the transition, I guess, with Ghassan Korban leaving and the power station and everything else that's going on with the surge in water board?
Well, the power station is under construction right now, so there'll be a new source of power. There'll be more reliability. We won't have to rely so much on just these old turbines and the way that they were, powered up. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is I just want to encourage everybody to just always be prepared. Expect the worst. Expect that there's going to be flooding. Expect that the power is going to go out. Expect that the drains aren't going to be able to take all of the water. And just be prepared. This is the season, and hurricane season, really, most of the hurricanes are in August are. Even September, we think about it because hurricane season starts in May. But at the end of the day, there's a hurricane that really takes place many times in the month of August. And just be prepared. Assume that it's going to happen. Have the plan for evacuation. Have the plan in place if you're going to stay, if you're going to have a generator. Make sure it's working right. It's far enough away from your house. But just be prepared because the Sewage and Water Board, nor the city, nor other agencies can handle the worst cases well, which is too much rain coming down in too short a period of time. And also you can just assume that the power is going to go out. Hopefully it stays on, but just assume the worst. That's all, Tommy.
Let's talk about the settlement, the $90 million that the city owes and so forth. How, Eugene, and look, let's leave personalities out of this because I know you don't like to do that, and I don't blame you. It's about the government and the city functioning and doing what they're supposed to do. How did the city get to owing $90 million in back judgments, and how do you fix it?
The city simply didn't pay its judgments for years. We have people who've been on the list to collect over a decade, and we simply didn't pay. I just can't describe it to you other than this council, for the first time, put aside some money, which was about $6 million a year for a couple of years to pay, but it would have been impossible to get to the end. And all of these are paying judgments that have been decided in court. The appeals processes are over, and people were just awaiting the money because they were owed it based on our court system. We're paying $90 million in judgments so that we can get the people who are owed paid, because it's a matter of fairness. It wasn't ever going to go away. So the bottom line is that we're selling bonds as a city so that we have a yearly obligation, but the people who are owed money get paid.
I think what makes me scratch my head about that is, we're not talking about a guy that or a woman that is irresponsible and doesn't conduct their affairs like they should. And, yeah, okay, you sue me, fine. It's a wallpaper judgment. You're not going to get a dime out of me. This is city government we're talking about. So there was no more appeal pending or anything else. It's like it was flat out clear night and day. You owe the money. And at some point, the city or whomever just decided not to pay it.
that's one of those instances where when people joke and say you can't sue City Hall, you can't beat City Hall. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you can get a judgment, but you can't really force City Hall to write a check. I mean, mm-hmm. a court is not going to say, take it out of this source, take it away from recreation, take it away from health care, take it away from the police, and pay a judgment. So the bottom line is that the city could go on forever because they were never going to get those kind of judgments against them in terms of forcing them to pay. We really had an obligation to pay the people for a very long period of time. It's almost been the source of a joke, you know, that, oh, man, you can expect that you're not going to get paid by the city. Go on and sue. But if you owed something, if there's been an injury, even a financial injury because of something that the city did wrong, if you're owed it, you should be paid. And this city council has finally said, okay, enough. We're not going to just continue to accumulate judgments and not pay people. We're going to sell bonds. And in the long run, the city is going to be better off because of it.
You're a smart guy, well-educated man, been around. Is this uncommon when it comes to city governments doing this? Is this naturally New Orleans? I hate to say that, but...
Well, I think that it, as I looked at it, a lot of other cities do the same thing because, very honestly, each year you want to budget according to your needs, and that includes roads, that includes health, that includes recreation, that includes cutting the trees, that includes cleaning the drains and things like that. Those are immediate obligations. It's easy to ignore people who have a judgment against you because when you pay that judgment, it doesn't get you a city service. It gets you paying somebody back who's owed money. And I think that's what we just looked at. It was hard to, as a city official, to say, you know something, we're going to pay something that's due in the past when we have all these obligations in front of us. But it was just time. I mean, this city council has done a few things in the midst of some of the challenges that we've had to overcome. And one of those things was to pay off those people who were paid. It was kind of like relocating people from Gordon Plaza. We just kept pushing it down the road year after year after year, and we got it done. And now all the residents of Gordon Plaza have been relocated from that dump.
Finally.
This is something that just needed to happen. Finally is right.
Finally. All right, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're going to talk about illegal dumping when we return. Eugene Green, our guest, New Orleans City Council member, 720 and a half. Time now, traffic, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member, about this and that. We've already talked about back judgments and $90 million that the city's finally going to pony up to those that have, I guess, earned it in court, if you want to say it that way, won their case in court. Eugene, for a long time, we've been talking about illegal dumping in the city. To me, the mindset of this, you know, I always say nothing just happens, right? Whether it's a PTA meeting or whatever it is, somebody has to set up the chairs, somebody has to bake the cookies for the bake sale, nothing just happens. But on the negative side of that, if you're going to dump something somewhere, somebody's going to have to pick that up. So I never did quite get the mindset there. A lot of people are irresponsible. Tell me what's going on with illegal dumping in the city and what's changed as far as enforcement, fines, penalties, et cetera.
Tommy, it's sometimes it's interestingly enough hard to grasp what's going on because it is so simple. There are criminals who have simply been paid to haul away matter and to haul away goods and to haul away refuse properly by people such as landlords, by people such as those who own tire shops, by people who have needs to have something hauled away, and they simply don't want to spend the money that they've made. They don't want to spend any portion of it, and so they find a dark area off of some street or some neighborhood, maybe under the interstate or something like that, where they can get away with it, and they dump. But yesterday, for example, it's interesting that I'm talking to you today. Yesterday morning at 9 a.m., well, at 8 a.m., I got a call saying that someone had dumped something illegally off Dalman Road on a street that's between Dalman Road and the post office. And the people in the post office couldn't get out. So federal officials were prohibited.
Really?
Because that's right. That's right. A load of tires was on a street. It's a real street. And it was left there, and the members of the Postal Service could not get out. Now, I will tell you, people don't see this much because our sanitation department does it every day. They got out there and were able to pick up the scores of tires in a short period of time. But I'm asking for a federal investigation because there's a law against blocking access to a federal facility. I'm asking the city of New Orleans to do its work in terms of the police tracking the cameras to find out who it is. But that's how bad it is. People just dump wherever they think that they can. And I say people, I'm talking about the criminals, not people in general.
Right.
Because interestingly enough, most things you can get picked up in front of your house. You can get four tires picked up in front of your house every week. You can get everything that's left outside and furniture and the like. No, these are criminals who have been paid for their work and they don't want to do the right thing. So now, Tommy, there were three arrests last week. There were three arrests. Unfortunately, people were coming from Slidell and from Gretna to do that dumping, but they did get caught. There are 13 investigations right now. So anybody who wants to illegally dump needs to know that there are investigations. Yesterday's incident is going to be investigated, and I'm asking the federal government, who is listening to us, that we need your help, because a lot of the dumping is done by people from other states, so that becomes interstate commerce. And also you saw yesterday that federal workers were prohibited from getting out to do their job of delivering mail because of the dumping of those tires. It's a serious problem. We're cracking down a little bit more. The biggest thing is it's going to take penalties, and it's going to take finding people and enforcing those penalties, charging them with the maximum charge once they're caught, not just something, a slap on the wrist, because it costs the city millions of dollars per year to remove litter and the product of illegal dumping.
Well, I got to tell you, I didn't realize that. Maybe I'm naive, but I didn't realize that it had become a cottage industry of people. Yeah, I'll haul it away for you. And obviously there's no expense involved for them. You know, just dump it wherever they find it. And that's why it's so important that the arrests are made and follow up, you know, happens with the conviction and penalties, et cetera. Is there anything the council can do by ordinance to stiffen penalties on that, Councilman?
Well, there are ordinances in place that suggest that your vehicle can be removed, that you can be imprisoned. The bottom line is that at the end of the day, once they're caught and the police will do the job of catching them, just as they're doing with these 13 investigations, the penalties need to be enforced to the maximum extent. Now, that involves the court system, the district attorney, and the like. But the bottom line is that I think that the ordinances are in place to make the penalty severe enough. We've just got to catch more people and to enforce them.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member. I'm going to tell y'all what, don't screw around with a post office or mailing or anything else like that, because you open yourself to a world of hurt. We'll take a break, come back, talk with the president of the Public Affairs Research Council about the ethics board and changes to the ethics laws in Louisiana. Right now, though, we pause for WWL First News. Right, 7:45, quarter till 8. I'm a West Banker, so to me, everything's across the river. So don't go by me. But just to be clear on the traffic, I got a text that says the St. Claude Bridge is open. Claiborne is out. The Sieber Bridge is out, not St. Claude. I just drove over it. If that makes sense to y'all, again, I'm a West Banker and everything's across the river to me. Stephen Procopio joins us now, president of the Public Affairs Research Council, to talk about ethics laws. How you doing, Stephen?
Great.
I see a story here by a friend, David Hammer, from WWL Louisiana, that you told him that this change in the ethics law tips the scales far too much in favor of making it difficult to enforce the ethics code. I presume you were quoted accurately?
Yes. I'd have to know when it was, because there were a lot of changes that went through that bill from its beginning. And at its beginning, it was awful.
But
to where it is now.
I'm sorry. Tell me how we wound up. That's the most important part of it. Although, you know, you don't know what's going to happen next session, but tell me where we are now and what changed, I guess, is what people need to know.
Sure. Now, to be clear, it's like a 40-page bill. So there's a lot of changes in there, and some of which I actually think are fine. They actually gave people that are accused of ethics complaints, they give them a lot more information and let them see, you know, the charges, and they also the people can make a statement, which actually what ethics told us is that they're all doing that already. So this is essentially putting into law some standard practices. There can be more reporting. So there are lots of things that I think are either fine or actually good. Mm-hmm. The issue is then there's just a lot of exceptions that were added, and the whole system I'm a little worried about. You know, so for example, there are things I'll call normal exceptions. Like they added the racing commission can essentially, even though they have horses that are racing in there that they have an interest in, can be on the racing commission that oversees, you know, the horse races. which seems like a conflict of interest. In fact, the ethics board told them it was a conflict of interest, so they went to the board of to the legislature and got it changed.
Wait, go back, go back and say that again, because you're talking about here not just, you know, not just a business endeavor, but a business endeavor upon which you can wager. And I'm not casting aspersions at anybody, but just it's early. Go back and tell people what changed again with the Racing Commission.
Sure. So you can be a member of the Racing Commission, but also have horses that are racing. So you have a vested interest. You could have. I'm not saying you do.
That's right. You could.
But you could have a conflict of interest in terms of, hey, I have to regulate this thing that I also, you know, partake in, which is a conflict of interest. And the Board of Ethics told them it was a conflict of interest. And they just went to the legislature and got it changed. But that is just one small part of the
bill. You confused me with they got it changed, meaning now you can. They didn't change it for the good, good being a relative term.
Right.
They changed it so that you can be a member of the commission and have an interest in a horse or whatever it is.
That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. So that's unfortunately not atypical of the type of things that can be changed. You know, that is obviously a move in the wrong direction. But compared to what was proposed, it's not existential. This will be a problem, and hopefully we can find ways to make it work. But
give me a couple of more for instances, if you can, Stephen.
There was something else allowing someone else from the to be added to the convention center, but it was pretty much very specific in whether you had to work at the convention center, the New Orleans Convention Center, for for a certain number of years and essentially be named, Steve. I don't know who the person is, but there was clearly a person that was working at the convention center and had interest and let them put back on there. I don't know who that person is. That one is so narrowly tailored. It's not as bad as the Racing Commission one. But in the more important issues are sort of the more systemic issues about investigation and what's being allowed and subpoenas, that this is a lot harder to do the work of the ethics board.
All right, let me tell you what. I think that would be a good point to stop, and we'll pick it up with subpoenas and investigations and talk about why. And one concern I have, Stephen, is that as we do everything we can to try to make taxes simpler and a more friendly business environment, you know, Louisiana used to have the reputation of business leaders would say, you know, you go everywhere, you got to grease some palms. But Louisiana, it's crazy. It's ridiculous. Everybody has a handout. And I think the last thing in the world from a business development standpoint we want is that reputation. Stephen Procopio, our guest president of the Public Affairs Research Council, will pick up the changes in the ethics laws with subpoenas and investigations when we come back. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, never enough time in the morning. Stephen Procopio, our guest president of the Public Affairs Research Council, talking about the ethics regulations and the weakening that happened with the session that's just concluded. Stephen, you were talking about subpoenas, I think it was, and investigations. Go ahead, please.
Right, sure. So to understand how the process works, there is a complaint that's made, and then after that, they can choose, the board can choose to do an investigation. And then if they determine that the investigation has found something, they'll send that on to a separate body, the Ethics Adjudicatory Board, which is a sort of an independent administrator that looks at it. And then they will render equivalency of a verdict. This whole thing has to kind of happen within a year. So some of the changes that were made, I said some of them are good, but there are also some ways to sort of delay it. We're using the subpoena and the extra subpoena abilities that now someone will have. Mm-hmm. So essentially to try and run out the clock. Now, I don't know that it's going to happen in every instance, and I think hopefully that will be efficient. And they also have ways to extend that. So I think what will probably happen, you'll see a lot of extensions, but what I want to make sure everyone's aware of when you see like a story that says, oh, ethics board asking for a lot of extensions, that there's a reason for that, because we're going to need that to make sure bad actors don't extend the clock.
Go ahead.
Because otherwise you could just, it's not like a regular criminal trial where it's like you can go on and whatever it is. It's like there's a limit to how long you can have an ethics investigation.
So I'm reading from David Hammer's story here. Every person who is the subject of an investigation could simply file a request for advisory opinion, and that would stop an investigation. It's a get away with it card. Talk about that, if you would, Stephen.
Yeah. So there's an additional language that they added and that says you can ask for an advisory opinion from the Board of Ethics. So you're about to do something like, hey, if I take this action, if I hire this person, if I enter in this contract, you're concerned maybe this is going to be a violation of the ethics code. So you will ask for an advisory opinion, and they'll send it back to you. And they're like, yes, this would be a problem, or no, it's fine, or maybe under these conditions. What this new law says is that an advisory opinion cannot be used as sort of evidence against someone. Because the problem is sometimes people will ask for an advisory opinion for something they're already doing. Mm-hmm. And say, hey, I'm doing this. Is this right? And then they can ethics board them. No, that wasn't right. And there's a little bit of a tension here because you have someone that may be under the current law really trying to figure out what they're doing is wrong so they can fix it. But sometimes the advisory board will be like, well, no. And not only that, we're not going to investigate you. And I can kind of see complaints there. It's like, well, why are you going to investigate someone that was trying to find out what's going on? The problem with putting in the law is that they're concerned, and I have these concerns, that you're doing something wrong, you ask for an advisory opinion, and you say, well, you can't investigate me because I asked for an advisory opinion, and that's how the law reads now. So there is a potential concern that people could use this as a shield, again, if you're a bad actor, to block it, which is a shame because we want people to get advisory opinions to know if they're doing the right thing or not. That should be encouraged. But on the other hand, I do have some worries that this is going to be used as sort of a mechanism to actually stop investigating.
Thank you, Stephen. You have to come back. Tucker, that is, 8:15. You look at the map, the tropical map. You see the green lines or oval, whatever you want to call it, with the yellow X and all of that. Area of low pressure, medium chance of tropical formation in the Gulf in the coming days. The circle goes to the east of the Florida Panhandle, just about to the border of Louisiana and Texas. But primarily, it's going to be a rain event, is what they're saying. Tropical depression could form. If it does, it would be named Dexter when it gets to the point of naming a storm. And if we're going to name something Dexter, given the serial nature of the name, serial killer nature of the name, I'm just soon it'd be a shoo-shoo. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff Palermo?
Here we go. Sorry about that, Tommy. How you doing today?
We're fine. I'm good. You?
I am doing well. I am doing well.
Have you, do you know what a shoo-shoo is, or is that a new
No, I do not. No, you'll have to.
A shoo-shoo is like when you have a firework and you light it and it doesn't really pop. It just kind of, that we call that a shoo-shoo in New Orleans, or maybe it's a West Bank thing. I don't know. But I realize sometimes I use these colloquialisms and people don't know what they mean. Let me talk about Trey Greene. I know Brian Kelly mentioned him yesterday. I was impressed by this young man from the first time that I saw him. Let's talk about, I guess, start there with Brian Kelly in media days, Jeff.
Yeah, Brian Kelly, really high on his team, and there's a lot, you know, he's not afraid of the expectations that are around this team. Most feel like it should get to the college football, should be one of the 12 teams that make the college football playoff. A lot of emphasis on winning game one. We all know that LSU has lost their last five season openers, and they are not running from that. They're not hiding from that. They're not saying, oh, well, you know, this game against Clemson, it's just another game on the schedule. No, they are really looking at it as we got to win this game. We have to win this game. Now, yes, they could go ahead and lose this game and still go 10-2 this season and make it into the college football playoff. But I think it's important for this program to get a win in the season opener. And this, when you look at their last five season opener losses, this might be their toughest test. So they're really, because this is going to be a very good Clemson team with a quarterback that's returning, just like Garrett Nussmeier, and you got to play at their place. It's not a neutral site game. So this will be a tough test. But Brian Kelly loves the fact that Garrett Nussmeier's got a year of experience under his belt. He thinks the offensive line is going to be, he said he's very bullish on the offensive line, even though they've lost four starters from that unit, and really feels what they've been able to do in the transfer portal as far as getting players to, in particular, help on the defensive side of the football will really give Blake Baker, the defensive coordinator, the tools he needs for LSU's defense to compete for an SEC championship.
And that brings me to another one of my favorite players, who is Whit Whitaker.
Whit Weeks.
I'm sorry. I just want to throw that extra WH in there.
Yeah, Whit Weeks is healthy. We remember in the bowl game, suffered a what at that time looked like a really gruesome injury on his ankle, but he's ready to go, and he's a fan favorite, obviously. And I think I really feel like Brian Kelly feels really good about. You know, this is a guy that's basically started for a year and a half, or has played a lot of football over the last two seasons. He gets to the football fast, and a healthy Whit Weeks, a healthy Harold Perkins, and playing him in the position where he can create the most havoc, which is the star position in this defense, which is kind of a hybrid linebacker defensive back position, and allows him to roam the field a little bit more. They really feel really good about those two guys in particular.
Yeah, I got so busy saying Whit. He doesn't pronounce it that way, does he?
Whit Weeks is how
it's
W-H-I-T.
It.
Yes.
But, you know, it's like the word what. I guess you would definitely, you would traditionally say what, but nobody actually does that. He's got a brother, too. What's his brother like?
Oh, he's got West Weeks on this team, and his brother was a guy that he could have easily ended up coming back, or it could have tried the NFL route, mm-hmm. but they actually redshirted him last year to give him an opportunity to, and he wasn't necessarily fully healthy last season, but he's healthy this year. They're thinking that a veteran guy like this, who's been around for a while, he started out at Virginia. This is his fourth season with the Tigers. They really feel like he could be one of those guys that can really contribute not only on defense but special teams as well.
Let me take a break. We'll talk about the quarterback position when we come back. Now everybody's got a room, right, Jeff? It's not a position anymore. Now everybody's got a room. It's the receiver room. It's the quarterback room. And it's interesting how phrases like that catch on. Jeff Palermo is our guest, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. If you go to WWL.com and look under Jeff Palermo, you'll find something entertaining to read. I can guarantee you that. 821 traffic now, WWL. Yeah, but it's not just me. Tim Zimmer, Manning Master Control, doing a tremendous job as always. You got Jordan Fiegel producing from an unknown location. And we get great guests like Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. So let's talk about the quarterback room or position, as it's otherwise known. Joe Burrow, year one, won 10 games in a bowl game. Year two, the Heisman. Jaden Daniels, won 10 games in a bowl game. Year two, the Heisman. Doug Nussmeier. Won 9 games and a bowl game. What about this year?
Well, that's the obviously the pattern tells you that Garrett Nussmeier should win the Heisman. It's just not that easy, though. But when you think about year ones for Joe Burrow and Jaden Daniels, they were good seasons. They were not great. I can make the argument that Garrett Nussmeier had a really good season last year. I mean, he threw for 4,000 yards. And Joe Burrow and Jaden Daniels certainly didn't reach that type of level in their first year as a starting quarterback. And Nussmeier threw for 29 touchdown passes a season ago. When you go back to Joe Burrow and Jaden Daniels, very few touchdown passes for those guys in their first year as a starting quarterback. So there's a couple things that Garrett Nussmeier is working on to help himself as far as not only win the Heisman, but help his team win a national championship. Talked about yesterday how he changed his body a little bit so that he can take on a little bit more of a pounding. He's going to look to run some more. Last year he threw 12 interceptions, and he feels like, you know, there were times where he tried to force it down the field. Instead, maybe he should have just tucked it and tried to run for a few yards, or at least get back to the line of scrimmage, or not try to do the dangerous play. I think we all remember the interception that he threw against Texas A&M that really changed the complexion of that game. That's out of the 12 interceptions that he threw a season ago. That's one that he would certainly love to have back. So it's hard, as Brian Kelly said, it's hard to say, hey, this guy is going to win the Heisman Trophy, because it's such a difficult award to win. But one of the things that Brian Kelly talked about was he didn't come back here to win the Heisman. He came back here to win a national championship. Nussmeier really feels like there's some unfinished business, and he feels he's got the talent around him. He's got a lot of speedy receivers. I think the key for LSU offensively this year is to develop a consistent running game or a ground game that they can really rely on. They just have not had a traditional rushing attack the last couple of seasons. Jaden Daniels, he was the guy that did it a couple of years ago, and then last year they really struggled to run the ball at times, especially key moments. So that will be something we'll be certainly watching once preseason camp gets going on. How are they going to be able to run the ball, especially with this new offensive line?
Jaden Daniels was the rushing game for LSU.
Yes.
Let's face it, he was the rushing game. And thank you for diplomatically correcting Garrett Nussmeier. I said Doug. Because, look, Jeff, things go by so fast. I still think of Doug Nussmeier sometimes the Saints quarterback. That was 1996, which was a while ago. But relatively speaking, things change so fast. Let's talk about LSU baseball real quick in the Major League Draft.
Well, they had five more players selected, starting with Daniel Dickerson in the sixth round yesterday to Milwaukee Brewers. Jared Jones went in the ninth round to the Pittsburgh Pirates. Jacob Myers, a local kid from Ascension Parish, who really came on strong out of the bullpen for LSU late in the season last year, also a ninth round pick to the Red Sox. Cade Woods, who barely pitched in his two seasons at LSU, went in the 10th round. He's been really pitching very well this summer in the Major League. It's like the Major League Baseball draft. They put a lot of prospects in a summer league, and teams get a chance to scout him a little more, and he's been pitching very well. And then Connor Ware, who started off strong for LSU last season and really faltered off, and I don't think he was really healthy when the season ended. He was drafted late. I think it was 15th or 16th round to the Mets. But interesting who was not drafted. Zach Collin was not drafted, so he's coming back. Chris Stanfield was not drafted. Will he come back, or will he pursue an undrafted, or will he just pursue and sign as an undrafted a rookie? And then Luis Hernandez, who's out of college eligibility, was not drafted either. That was kind of sad to see, because he meant so much to this 2025 national championship team. He'll now try to sign with someone as an undrafted player and try to make his way up through the minors that way to Major League Baseball.
If he's good enough, he'll make it. August 1st, still the starting date for fall practice, Jeff, as far as you know?
That sounds about right. It's probably right around there. August 30th, obviously, the season opener at Clemson.
Yep. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it as always. We'll take a break, talk to Jeff Nowak, and we come back about the Saints. Right now, we pause for WWL First News. 8:47, 13 until 9. Soon the steamy fields of summer will yield the champion of autumn. That's not terrible. Tommy Tucker, 8:47, 13 till 9 with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
You're doing good. That was a nice lead-in. I think, you know, but I think by football season you'll have it nailed down.
By football season, the steamy feel. Man, I was watching some stuff. I like to put on when I pump aluminum. I was saying this the other day. I like to put on innocuous stuff, so I don't really have to pay attention to it. And I saw some NFL classic stuff from the 1960s and 70s, but it was done in the 80s, I guess. And whatever I saw, they had scores running at the bottom on a crawl of when the Oakland A's were in their Moneyball phase. So, man, that was a whole bunch of history on TV at one time. Let's talk about the Saints. What are you looking forward to, and what are they doing now? I guess off all on their individual pursuits?
Yeah, I mean, players are going to report soon. I can't remember the exact day, but, you know, we'll have practice kicking off, late next week. Yeah, at this point, it's kind of just a waiting game. The only thing that really hasn't happened yet that we're still kind of trying to see is Tyler Shuck signing his rookie contract. Mm-hmm. 30 of 32 second-round picks in the NFL this year have not signed their rookie contracts. The first two picks of the second round, who were Jaden Higgins and Carson Schwechinger, they got fully guaranteed deals. The first time a second-round pick's ever got a fully guaranteed deal. Mm-hmm. So now, as you can imagine, there's some conversation going on with the teams and the agents about fully guaranteed deals down the line. Tyler Shuck is the number 40 pick, but he's the quarterback. So, you know, there's a positional value there that kind of makes him one of the lead dogs in that conversation. So
is there a lot of leeway, Jeff, though, when it comes with the CBA about contracts, rookie contracts?
About About guaranteed money for the second round picks, yes. And it's, we've seen in the past these contracts get dragged out down the line. Alonzo Taylor didn't sign his contract until he reported for camp. I remember Foskey a couple years ago, similar situation. And so it's mostly just, the agents trying to get the best deal for the player. What makes it interesting this year is the fully guaranteed contracts because, you know, for example, Tyler, if he signs a fully guaranteed contract at number 40, all the players ahead of him will have the leverage to say, I want a fully guaranteed contract. Mm-hmm. So he'd be effectively negotiating the contracts of everyone ahead of him. And that would be true if he took a non-guaranteed deal for all the players behind him. Mm. So if Tyler agrees to whatever terms these are, then, you know, it's all kind of tiered. Mm. So the 41st pick would have, okay, well, that's what he signed for. This is what I'll sign for. So once one guy signs, it'll start to move down. And I think teams are invested in making sure that that isn't a fully guaranteed contract. They don't want to set that precedent. But that's kind of a minor deal. The only reason I bring it up is because the biggest thing to talk about is the quarterback competition. Mm-hmm. And at this juncture, we're not sure if he's going to be there. And I expect him to be there, but I'm just really kind of setting that tone of hopefully that's the case. And it's not something we end up talking about, but it's kind of the topic of conversation right now. And the Saints are in a more disadvantaged situation if that does happen, because it's the quarterback position, and he's a guy who you think might go in there and win that job. So that's kind of the biggest thing, and we'll see how that quarterback competition looks, whether he's there or not. I'm really intrigued to see Spencer Rattler and how he's going to attack this training camp, because, you know, I think there's a chance that both these guys show up and look really good. I expect Tyler to show up and look like a rookie, look like a guy kind of making that transition. I want to see Spencer show up and look like a guy who's ready to play right away. So that's going to be the biggest question.
Let me take a quick break. We'll pick it up. We come back. You know, if I'm Shuck's dad or agent, I'm telling that young man to sign your deal and get your rear end in the camp, because I don't think you want to be pulling a holdout. However, you talked about it was somewhat tiered. I guess it's also, it's not to be make a pun or anything, but it's somewhat peered as well, because his peers are kind of watching what he does, right?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. That's exactly what's going on.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up with Jeff Nowak when we come back. 851 traffic, WWL. All right, 8:57 and a half. Quickly back to Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, talking about the quarterback position. Tyler Shucks yet to sign his deal. Spencer Rattler, the Rattler, as I understand it, has been holding out some, holding some sessions with some receivers. What's going on there?
Yeah, so all the quarterbacks have been out throwing with the receivers, right? So Spencer wasn't able to be a part of the first session they had. He was holding a camp out in South Carolina, does it annually. So he had a session out in Arizona. And that's what you want to see this time of year, is those receivers, those quarterbacks building that chemistry, that camaraderie. Because, you know, new offense, new defense, like all of these systems that we've been used to watching are going to be a lot different. So, yeah, that's a big part of this stage of the offseason.
So could Tyler Shuck have sessions with the receivers or not until he signs?
Oh, he can. Yeah. You know, they can do whatever. There's a reason they call them OTAs organized team activities throughout the process.
So unorganized, you can do whatever you want.
Disorganized, I guess.
Disorganized.
It's really a matter of who's organizing them. So if they're organized by the team, you have a limited number of things you can do and the amount of time you can spend. And the players are able to do whatever they want on their own. So that's why you see, yeah.
Well, that was a dumb question. I shouldn't have asked it. But do what they want on their own up until their contract says they can't. Like, you don't want somebody to, like, doing stupid stuff, right?
Sure, you don't want people taking ski trips 2 weeks before the season, which in the summer would be tough to do, but you get the idea.
So when it comes to, and we only have a minute left here, when it comes to going into training camp and dividing up reps, is there a listed starter? Do you divide them up equally between a Rattler and Tyler Shuck?
That's what we're going to have to find out. They did divide them up equally during minicamp, but the question is, okay, you're going to have Jake Haener in the mix. How many do you have for each guy? And how long does that last? But that's probably what you're going
to
look at.
If you had to guess right now, just guess. No, I'm not holding you to this, but looking in the Nowak crystal ball, what would you say? Who's the starter come opening day?
Rattler.
Okay.
My guess.
The Rattler. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Appreciate it as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. We'll take a break, come back, talk about people taking their vacation. Do you take all of yours or not? And then we're going to talk about a new sporting event coming to town that has me shaking my head. The participants shake their heads as well. We'll be back, WWL. Bruce, appreciate it. It is 9:09, and we're going to talk about vacations, and I would love to hear from you all on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line, and I'll read some of your texts at 504-260-1870. Don't ever text and drive. Please don't ever text and drive, and if you do, I'm going to send Tim out there. Tim's going to come get you, so be aware of that. We're talking about vacation. Do you feel guilty about taking time off of work? Do you use all of your days off? Nearly half of Americans don't take all the vacation days, and many of us feel vacation guilt. I don't really feel vacation guilt. I have a love-hate thing with vacation where, well, first of all, I love my job, and I'm very blessed. You all know that. I love being here. But I hate the end of vacations. I like the idea of going on vacations, but the idea of, okay, it's Friday, vacation's over, get ready to come back, get back in a groove of going to work. That part I don't like so much. So as a result of that, sometimes I just avoid vacation. Joining us now is Dr. Karen Tan. She's an assistant professor of the Tourism and Hospitality Management Program at Middle Tennessee State University. Prior to earning her PhD in Tourism Management from Temple University in Philadelphia, she accumulated close to a decade of industry experience as a tourism and hospitality consultant by working on numerous projects in over 20 countries across Asia Pacific and the Americas. Her rich industry experience now serves as inspiration for her research on tourist well-being. And for that, and with that, rather, we welcome in Dr. Karen. Is it Tan or Tan?
It's Tan.
Dr. Karen Tan. How are you? Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, Tommy. Thank you for having me. I'm very well. I just came back from a vacation, and I absolutely feel no guilt about that.
May I ask where you went? Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I went back to Singapore to visit family, and I had an excellent time enjoying the hot weather there and great food as well.
Oh, you went hot weather. You didn't have to go to Singapore. You could have come here. And you could have gotten some great food as well. Have you been to New Orleans, Dr. Tan?
Not yet. It's on my bucket list of places to visit, though. Well, I hear that the food there is just awesome.
It is. You come down, we'll see to it that you get a great meal. I promise you that. Let's talk about What do you study when it comes to vacation, and what has your research shown as it relates to people taking vacation? Do they feel guilty about it? Are they afraid of their jobs? Do they feel like they're letting their fellow workers down? Take all of that and jump in where you feel comfortable.
Yeah, sure. Well, as you mentioned earlier, I have worked in so many different countries around the world, and when I first moved over to America, I was surprised that, you know, so many American colleagues actually feel guilty about going on vacation. So that pushed me to kind of like look deeper into the issue here. And this particular piece of research that I did on vacation guilt in America actually showed me that one in five employees in America who attempt to take PTO for vacations, they end up experiencing vacation guilt. Now, vacation guilt is when an individual wants to go on a vacation, but, you know, he or she ends up feeling bad, anxious, guilty, incompetent, or uncertain for wanting to do so. Feeling this way about vacations is unusual in that, you know, taking a vacation is not generally viewed as a bad or awful behavior, unlike, say, telling a lie. After all, going on vacations benefit individuals like you and I on so many different levels, right? Ranging from health to wellness restoration to having the opportunity to learn new things. And my study found that, you know, this employees who experience vacation guilt, they feel this way because their coworkers and or their bosses make them feel like that. Their coworkers, their bosses actually make them feel that vacation taking violates how an ideal employee should behave. To such co-workers and bosses, an ideal employee should always be around for the company, should always be physically present. And now that does not necessarily equate to doing more work. They just need to be physically present to signal their commitment, to signal their dedication to the company. And individuals who are not present, you know, by so-called quote-unquote disappearing on a vacation, they are essentially perceived by their co-workers as not pulling their weight or are not serious about their work. So they end up feeling guilty about going on vacations.
So not necessarily it's about what they do, but just being there, even if they're not doing anything, just hanging around, kind of like our producers here. I'm just kidding.
Oops.
I'm just playing. No, I'm just teasing. They do a tremendous job, and they all know that. I'm just playing. No, but is it but those people that are feeding that guilt, do they take vacation themselves?
Both yes and no. Well, for people, for some individuals who may actually be concerned about job security, they may actually choose to not go on vacations, right? They may, some of them actually feel threatened enough that, you know, if they come back, there won't be a job for them anymore. So they choose to not go on vacations. And in the same study that I did, some of my interviewees told me that, yeah, they still, you know, bit the bullet. They still chose to go on vacation.
No, wait, now just listen to what you just said. Bit the bullet and chose to go on vacation as though it's an unpleasant thing, right?
It is, because to them it is, because they end up, they feel that they end up being penalized for that. These interviewees, they feel that when at the end of the day, you know, come annual evaluation, performance evaluation and all that, they feel that their overall performance is actually underrated because they disappeared for their vacations. They feel that they have been passed up for promotions because they were not dedicated enough to give up their vacations for their company.
When it comes to the importance of vacation, there have been numerous studies that show you got to, what is it, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, right? That goes back 1,000 years, but that's the fact, right?
It is a fact. There's a very established stream of research showing all the positive benefits of going on vacations. I mean, you feel good when you're on vacation, right? And of course, you may feel disappointed when your vacation ends, as do, you know, just like, you know, you feel disappointed when anything good, anything pleasant comes to an end, you feel disappointed. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you will still go back to work feeling restored, feeling like, you know, refreshed, feeling that you have more creative, more creativity. You feel that you can, you know, run further and all of that. And in fact, you know, studies have also shown that by going on vacation, you learn new things. You are exposed to new ideas, new culture, new experiences, and all this benefit you as an individual, as an employee as well.
Is this a uniquely American thing?
Well, not quite. It is not uniquely an American thing. Mm-hmm. There are some countries that experience it more than America, and in fact, Japan is probably the country in the world where vacation guilt is the most prevalent. In Japan, not utilizing paid vacation leave is traditionally seen as an unwritten rule to signal serious commitment to a company. I mean, in their culture, you know, being physically present at work signals commitment, which is also partly why it is normal for them to clock 60 to 70 hours a week at work, even if there is no overtime pay.
When it comes to the time that people take off, well, let me take a step back first. Let me try to put this against some kind of baseline or timeline. Is this a relatively new trend? Did people embrace their vacations in the, I don't know, the 60s, the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now all of a sudden it's not that way, or what? Or do you know, Doctor?
Well, it is not quite a new trend, but it is a trend that seems to be pretty insidious, as in is a trend that is taking many years to actually surface. Why do I say that? It's because when I look at the amount of paid time off that's actually being given to American employees, over the last 20 years, the amount of PTO has actually been given has actually increased. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the amount of paid time off being used by employees has actually decreased. So it's a slow, these two trends are happening over a very long period of time of say about 20 years. And it is something that is not, that doesn't happen overnight.
I don't, I get 20 days of vacation a year, I think is the way it works. I don't know if they've changed it. I don't quite understand because I don't take it. But because before I got into radio, one of the things I would hate is that when I would turn the radio on, the person that I wanted to listen to wasn't there. And I made up my mind. I'm not slapping myself on the back. I'm not. Maybe people hate it. Maybe people wish I took more vacation. But that's why I don't take a lot of vacation. I may take a couple of days coming up here for some dental work. Well, anyway, that's not the point. But the point is, I love working, and I don't mind taking, and I don't want to take vacation. But what would your advice? Go ahead.
Tell me, you feel. Because that's because you love your job. You love what you are doing. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of the individuals out there who cannot or who have PTO but cannot take it for vacations, it's not because they love their job. It's because they are made to feel bad for going on vacations. Their companies, their organizations make them feel bad about it. It's not because they love their job. It's two different things altogether to me.
Somebody texted in and said, my boss tries everything they can to deny vacation time. Then if they can't, they try to talk you out of taking it or putting you on a guilt trip. And look, the cynical part of me, the business part of me says, you know, I can fully understand this where, hey, look, here you go. Congratulations. I'm going to give you 20 days of paid vacation. That sounds great. Until you try to use it, then I'm going to make you feel like a leper or a deserter or Benedict Arnold. Right.
That's exactly what my study reflected as well. So many of my interviewees, so many of my respondents, they are given paid time off. But being given that paid time off is different from having the opportunity to use it.
So what is the trend here moving forward? Do people start taking less vacation? You can only squeeze so much stuff. I'm no Karen Tan, okay? I'm no PhD, but I can tell you this. You can only squeeze so much stuff into a pipe until it breaks. And along those lines, it would seem like we're squeezing stuff into a pipe here, and eventually it's going to break. Thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. I think that actually what we are seeing in America right now is the beginning roots of more harmful workplace norms, which could obviously impact healthcare problems and costs. I mean, if we take a leaf out of the book of Japan, you know, I'm not saying that we are America is like Japan right now, but it is starting to become like Japan. And we know that the workplace health, workplace norms in Japan is not something that, you know, we want to mimic or we want to work towards. So if, in any case, in America, if we don't want to go down the route of Japan, I think a lot of actions have to be taken to encourage companies and encourage organizations to provide the culture to encourage employees to go on vacations. It's not just about giving them those few days of PTO.
All right, let me take a break. We're going to pick it up here. We come back. I want to hear from y'all on the Oakman Art Jeweler Talking Text Line, 504-260-1870. No texting and driving, or Tim will come after you. But do you take the amount of vacation that you have? If not, why not? Do you wish you had more? Is it a money thing? People are texting saying that they can't afford to go on vacation, but you can always just take some time off and get some stuff done around the house, although painting your house you wouldn't think would be a vacation. However, it can, I guess, give you some mental stress and you get something done, and at least you're not doing the same stuff you do at work. Karen Tan is our guest. She's an assistant professor at the Department of Health and Human Performance, Middle Tennessee State University, and we're talking about vacation guilt. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. All right, 9:29. We're talking to Dr. Karen Tan, assistant professor at the Department of Health and Human Performance, Middle Tennessee State University, about vacation guilt. Some of the texts that are coming in. I think if you're going to take a vacation, you should be conscious about getting ahead of your work. I wouldn't want my work to fall on someone else if I can help it. Some people have no issue with passing on the work. Somebody else texted and said, it's funny, though, and this is what we were talking about, Professor. It's funny, though, when they're recruiting you, they brag about how much PTO you get. Then once you get hired, they ridicule you for wanting to use it. Somebody else wants to know, you can't even get this younger generation to work vacation. Give me a break. And I would add to that, get out of my yard while you're at it. Somebody else says, I'm always afraid of what my boss will have to do while I'm away. Somebody else said, that they're concerned with somebody messing up their job and going through their personal stuff because they have a way of doing things and they don't want it undone. Is that some of the stuff you heard in your survey as well?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they pretty much mirror what my study uncovered.
So when somebody else texted in and said, please ask her what the bosses have to say about this, the bosses being a generic term, of course, but does pressure come from up top on this, or is this an unwritten kind of thing, or is it, I would guess it happens where top management does it subtly with the next level of management, and then it filters down. Accurate or not?
Yes, pretty much that way. And a lot of times, I shouldn't say a lot of times, but sometimes it's not even top down. Sometimes it's just middle management level employees who feel the need to prove themselves. So they put the pressure on the people that they are supervising, even though there is no such pressure from the guys right on top.
Have you talked about vacation remorse at all, where people take a vacation and while they're taking it, they feel fine, but then when they get back, they're sorry they did?
Oh, that's something new to me. No, it could be my next research piece, Tommy.
Well, please feel free to use it and mention me, if you could, in a footnote or something like that, because I don't think I've ever been footnoted. So for people that are listening, I know you can't give people personal advice or not, but how do you balance, or from the results of your survey, how do you balance the importance of taking vacation and rejuvenating and unplugging and refreshing and recharging and all of that with the balance of you gotta work, you gotta keep your job and all of the other concerns?
Well, that is a very difficult question or situation to advise on, mm-hmm. because a lot of it is very personal, right? Like what you mentioned, do you want your job, mm-hmm. or do you want to be employed still, or do you want to, just be on permanent vacation? So a lot of it is, I think, may not necessarily come from the individual, but more so perhaps society in general needs to change their perspective or be more supportive of vacation taking. And in fact, in America, I think that it would be helpful if legislation is implemented to guarantee employees a minimum number of days of paid time off every year. I mean, when we look at all the information from advanced societies around the world, America right now is the only advanced economy that does not have such legislation in place. All advanced societies have some sort of minimum legislation to protect employees' rights. So that could be one step that America takes at this point in time to help change the culture around vacation taking.
I'm getting a lot of text on this, and to put them all together, the word would be insidious, I think, where they think they have mm-hmm. this insidious effect of taking vacation where, okay, go ahead and take your vacation time. You get your 20 days, take them all. However, deep down, you're on, quotation marks, the list. And we know who we can count on and who we can't count on. Is that a fact of life, or are people making stuff up in their heads?
No, that is what my study actually reflects as well. And I think that this feelings or these perceptions, they are not as evident in countries where, such as Europe, where vacation taking is the norm, where employees do not feel guilty or feel much less guilt about going on vacations because they know that they are protected by legislation if they do, go on vacations.
Somebody texted in and said, and I think this is part of this as well, that they're in a situation where their department has been downsized. Now they're doing the work of five people for the same money, but they're in a tough spot because they're happy that they still have their job, even though they're doing the work of five people for the same money, but at least they still have a job. Is that the trend in America?
Yes and no. It depends on, at least based on my study, it depends pretty much on the phase of life you are in. I see a lot of that amongst employees who are in the more initial stages of their career and who actually feel a greater desire to want to demonstrate more commitment, more time at work to their company. So they choose to put up with more work at the same amount of pay, or they choose to sacrifice their PTO for vacations, and just so that because they choose to use that as a means of getting ahead at work.
I know you've studied this in other countries. What about Germany? Have you looked at Germany?
Well, not yet. It is on my list of things to do.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering how they handled it there, because, you know, Norm Macdonald, the late comedian, said that Germany is a medium-sized country in Europe, and for the most part, they took on the world twice and almost won. So they seem to know what they're know what they're doing there, and it's true, really, if you think about it. So, for what countries are the most vacation friendly, at least from your studies that you found?
My study did not look at other countries, but to the best of my knowledge, based on my understanding of different work cultures around the world, right now Europe seems to be the most vacation friendly. Again, you know, it
goes
back to
Europe.
The general, Europe. Of course, there are many different countries in Europe, and each country has its own legislation. But generally speaking, that part of the world, they protect employees' rights to pay time off for vacations. And it's not just about legislation in Europe. They also have very strong union backing when it comes to workplace rights, employees' health and well-being. So all of that means that typically in Europe, employees actually have at least 20 working days on top of paid holidays such as Christmas and New Year's.
Do you enjoy taking vacation yourself, Professor?
Oh, I love going on vacations. That's why I'm in this industry, in tourism and hospitality.
Well, how would you know if you're on vacation, I guess, now that I think about it, if you study tourism? I'm just kidding. Thank you. It's been very interesting. Dr. Karen Tan, Assistant Professor at the Department of Health and Human Performance, Middle Tennessee State University. Keep the text coming in at 504-260-1870 about vacation. Somebody texted in and said, my favorite work schedule is 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 months a year, which is interesting. Somebody else said greedy owners and stockholders won't hire enough people to cover vacation and PTO. And somebody else said that's why other countries depend on us, I guess, given the American work ethic. However, I don't know if it's always been that way, or if back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, people would take their full allotment of vacation. Now, as a kid, I don't think I can. My dad owned a service station. I can't really remember going on vacation as a kid other than with an aunt. When we come back, we're going to talk about this power slap event that's coming to New Orleans. Tim has been telling me about this sport for years now, and it's just amazing. I don't know why somebody would want to do it, but it is interesting to watch. 9:39, 21 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:45, quarter till 10. I've been looking forward to this. Tim Zimmer alerted me to this. How long ago, Tim? 18 months, maybe? 2 years? About 2 or 3 years ago. Frank Lamasella joins us now, president of Power Slap. Tim is enamored with this, and he shows me the highlights, as are a lot of people. Over 17 billion views across all social media outlets. It's coming here to town on Friday night at the Xavier Convocation Center on Xavier's campus. You can get tickets and find out more at powerslap.com. Couple of championship matches. You got Damian DeBell, whose nickname is The Bell, against Wes Mina for the heavyweight championship. Then you got Robert Trujillo against Dakota McGregor for the lightweight championship. With that, we welcome in Frank Lamasella. How you doing, Frank?
What's up, Tommy? How are you?
I'm all right. I got to ask, where did the idea come from for this sport?
So about 5-6 years ago, we started watching some of these slap fighting videos on YouTube coming out of Russia and Poland and other places, and they were doing like 300 million views on a YouTube video. So, you know, credit to Dana White. He saw how explosive the content was and said, hey, let's do this the right way, put the power of the UFC machine behind it and see where we go. And, you know, we're up to this is our 14th show, our first one outside of Vegas in the U.S. We've done 3 seasons of a reality show, and, you know, the sport's on fire, the promotion's on fire, we're just getting started.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. The first event outside of Las Vegas in the United States, one in Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia. When it comes to the sport itself, for people that are not aware, Frank, describe it, if you would, please, what a match looks like.
Sure. So the first thing to note is that all these fights are regulated and sanctioned by the state athletic commissions. So we are approved as a combat sport here in Louisiana, which is one of the reasons why we decided to come here at this time. And so the sport is simple. You know, 2 guys stand across the table. They go slap for slap. It's usually 3 or 5 rounds, 5 rounds for the title fights. You know, there are rules like you can't lift your feet or pivot. You know, you can't, you have to land the slap in a very small target area on your opponent's face, and you can win by knockout or decision. A lot of these fights go, you know, the full 3 rounds, and the judges decide who was the winner.
I got to confess, my headphones came unplugged, so I missed a part of it if you said it. Did you determine this with a coin toss as far as who goes first?
That, you know, the coin toss determines who goes first, but believe it or not, we've done, you know, about 250 matches at this point, and it's right about 50%, meaning whoever wins the coin toss wins 50% of the time, whoever loses it loses 50%
of
the time.
So no discernible advantage at all?
No, none.
So if I were to sign up for a power slap competition and I win the toss and I slap my opponent and he doesn't go down, can I quit?
We don't like people who quit after the first
time. No, I understand that. I'm kidding. But I tell you, after watching it, I think I would. Tell me about people think that there is an art to this, a technique to this, a science to this, right? Tell me what some of the key components are, I guess. And,
yeah.
And then we'll go from there to some of the things you can do wrong. What do you want to do right?
So there's absolutely an art and science to it. And, you know, we hold regular training camps out in Vegas, and you can see how much better the guys are getting, the ones who come to the camps and train and practice, because you have to generate a lot of power and speed, and you have to land in only one spot on your opponent with that power and speed. And if you miss and you foul, you pretty much lose the fight, because you lose a point, and in a 3-round fight, it's really hard to win if you foul. So you got to do all that right, and then and when you take the slap, you got to actually learn how to brace for the slap. You have to train certain muscles in your body, and like I said, these guys who are training, we see a huge discernible, benefit from them actually getting out there and training.
So, what is it? Because I got to tell you, and I don't mean this sounds terrible to say this, but what you're talking about is physics. And when I saw it, the first thing I thought of is hitting a golf ball, because you got to have the sweet spot of the club on the right spot on the ball, and you have to be going fast, but weight also determines it, right? Have you ever looked into the physics of any of this, Frank?
It's a great comparison. Like I said, in slap, there's certain things you can't do. Like, we have a lot of, you know, we have a lot of former MMA or boxers that participate in power slap. And, you know, one of the things they teach you when you're learning, you know, boxing is you always pivot your foot and you generate power that way. Mm-hmm. And in power slap, that's something you can't do. So
yeah, talk about
really,
that, if you would, yeah, about the technique, because you can't, first of all, you can't pivot like you're saying, like swinging a golf club. And on the other side of it, you can't flinch. Or tell me about that.
Correct. So when you're striking someone, you can't pivot. You can't step like a baseball pitcher. And you need to use a flat open hand. And the other thing you have to do is you have to call your hand and call your number, meaning, you know, right on 3. So you use your right hand and land on the third windup.
So what you say is, and for people that have not seen this, you're going, you can say 1, 2, or 3, and then you go 1, 2, and you can't go on 2
right.
If you say 3. You got to go on what number you say, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And it sounds simple, but when the lights are on and 4,000 people are looking at you, people actually do make mistakes there.
And tell me about clubbing and cupping the hand and so forth.
Yeah, so you have to use a flat open hand. You know, we want people landing with the palm of their hand. You can't lead with your wrist bone. Obviously, you can't use a closed fist. You can't use a cupped hand. So flat open hand. And then on the defensive side, you know, like I said, you got to learn how to brace to receive the slap. You can't flinch. If you flinch, meaning if you move out of the way when the slap is coming, your opponent gets to slap you again. So, you know, we advise no flinching because you never really escape what you're trying to escape anyway. Mm. And, you know, you go back and forth. We got a lot of tough guys, tough girls. We have incredible champions. Like you said, two title fights this weekend, and we're really pumped to be in New Orleans.
Tell me about the holding the thing behind your back. What is all that about? I don't understand that. That the floaty or whatever it is.
You know, we when we were kind of seeing what other people were doing out there when we first saw the sport. I mean, look, part of that is just to keep a defensive posture consistent across all the guys. Mm-hmm. You know, we got guys who are 6'5", 5'6", you know, 400-pound super heavyweights, 155-pound lightweights. So by having that, you know, the slapstick that they hold behind their back, it makes it consistent across all the fighters, and it also helps you keep your shoulders down, which is one of the rules.
Slapstick, but there's nothing funny about it. When it comes, Frank, to has anything ever happened? Have you ever had an opponent that just at the last second said, no, I don't think so, I'm out?
Yeah, I mean, we you know, we've had that before, actually, in the co-main event. Our lightweight champion, Robert Trujillo, he fought somebody a few years ago, and his opponent kind of bailed out after they gave the first slap and didn't knock him out. It's happened only a couple of times. You know, like I said, we got a lot of tough dudes and girls who want to be up there and earn their keep. But we've seen it once or twice.
Have you ever taken one of these or not?
Definitely not.
I can't imagine. I can't even imagine what that must feel like.
Dana and I like promoting the sport and running the business, but we don't participate.
I don't think I've been slapped in the face since like fourth grade, and she was maybe 85 pounds, and that hurt, so I can't imagine this.
Yeah.
Tell me
yep.
again about the event and how people can go to it and find tickets, and how can they find out more about it, Frank?
So you can learn more at powerslap.com, but you can buy tickets on AXS. The event is this Friday at the Xavier Convocation Center. Doors open at 6:45. The first fight is at 8 o'clock. And all I would say is, I mean, this event is an incredibly fun event. It's unlike anything you've ever seen before live. And if you're in New Orleans this weekend for the fights, you know, you got UFC Dustin Poirier's last fight on Saturday, and then you got Power Slap on Friday. It's the perfect combat sports weekend.
About how long does the whole thing last, Frank?
Two and a half to 3 hours.
Okay, and tell me real quick about the rounds again. Each person slaps each other three times. That's how it's structured?
You either have three rounds or five rounds, depending on whether it's a non-title or title fight. The other thing we're doing too, Tommy, after the Power Slap event, we're hosting an after party at Caesars New Orleans.
Okay.
It's something we've always done with Power Slap in Vegas. We always have a gambling fun after party. And
some celebrities, I'm guessing?
Perfect host for that.
Some celebrities,
absolutely.
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have 300, you know, celebrities, influencers, content creators in the crowd. They always come through to the after party. So, again, if you're in town, you come to Power Slap on Friday, Caesars right after it, and then UFC on Saturday.
So powerslap.com. That's what people need to remember, correct?
Correct.
And Friday night. Thank you. I appreciate your time, Frank. I really do. It's
Thank
something
you,
to
Tommy.
See, man.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Frank Lamasella, president of Power Slap. 9:55. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got coming up for us when we return on WWL.